Welcome to the fourth live seminar in the Advent of Evolutionary Christianity, Conversations at the Leading Edge of Faith. I'm Michael Dowd, and I'm your host for this series, which can be accessed at evolutionarychristianity.com. Tonight, our theme is Evolving Church, and we have five respected Christian evolutionaries, all of whom have extensive experience working with congregations and ministries. We have emerging church luminaries Brian McLaren and Sally Morgenthaler, progressive pastors Ian Lawton and Greta Vosper, and evolutionary mystic and pastor Bruce Sanguin, who is Skyping in from Australia. Before I more fully introduce our guests, I want to reiterate a request that I've made the last two seminars. Connie and I are in the process of creating both individual and institutional study guides for all the entire series, and we need your help. Collective intelligence requires the input of many, not just a few, and that means you. So please submit questions for reflection or discussion on any of the one-on-one conversations or any of the seminars by going to the blog post titled, Please Help Us Create Study Guides. Or you can email me at feedback@evolutionarychristianity.com. And what we're hoping for are questions for each interview and each panel. And I'm imagining that, you know, if we've got a dozen or two dozen people that are willing to just listen to one or two or three and then come up with questions for reflection or discussion, we'd have just a lot of really great ones that can go beyond what just a few of us could think of. So today I'm excited to discuss or to bring into our discussion of Evolving Church the following thought leaders and action leaders. Greta Vosper is the founder of the Canadian Center for Progressive Christianity. She pastors West Hill United Church just outside of Toronto, and her best-selling book, With or Without God, Why the Way We Live is More Important Than What We Believe, made Amazon's list of top 25 books that, quote, caused a commotion. She advocates, among other things, that the Bible is not the authoritative word of God for all time and encourages churchgoers to drop dogmatic beliefs and cultivate a heart for the well-being of all of life. Brian McLaren was featured by Time Magazine as one of America's 25 most influential evangelicals. He's on the board, he's the board chair of Sojourners Call to Renewal, and a founding member of Red Letter Christians. He's written a bunch of books. His book, A Generous Orthodoxy, is widely considered to be a manifesto of the emerging church movement. And his book, A New Kind of Christianity, explores the intersection of Christian faith with contemporary culture and global crises. Bruce Sanguin is minister at Canadian Memorial United Church in Vancouver, Canada. Got two Canadians with us tonight. He's the author of a number of books also. Darwin, Divinity and the Dance of the Cosmos is perhaps his most widely known. And his latest book, If Darwin Prayed, synthesizes science, scripture, and poetry into 21st century prayers for congregational worship and personal devotion. Ian Lawton is minister at C3 Exchange. It's a church that recently made national headlines for the controversial decision to remove the cross from their church. Ian is ordained as an Anglican priest, and he's worked on the inner city streets of Sydney, which inspired him to take up the mantle of creating a more inclusive and inspirational Christianity. And Sally Morgenthaler is a gifted nature photographer and best-selling evangelical author. She has taught graduate and undergraduate courses in contemporary worship at Yale University, Asbury Theological Seminary, Bethel Theological Seminary, Fuller, Baylor University, Oral Roberts, and Texas Christian University. Just as a reminder to my my guests that I will have you on mute, but if I find that it works well, I'm going to actually unmute you all. It's just that we don't want to have a lot of noise in the background. But here's my request, at least as we get going. I'm going to read a question that either is submitted via live. In fact, for those of you that are accessing this by computer, if you don't see a box for typing in your question, go ahead and just refresh your web page and then hit the play button again and the box will appear. So I'll be reading questions submitted that way, as well as we've got half a dozen or more that were submitted ahead of time. And if one of the five of you would like to, or however many of you would like to respond to that particular question, please press *2 on your phone. Let's see, I'm not sure how that's going to work for you, Ian, so I might just leave you unmuted, so just be conscious of the background noise. But if I see your hand, *2, then I'll know that you want to respond to that particular question. But this first one, I'm actually going to unmute all of you because I really would love to hear each of you respond to this question, which is, what does evolving church mean to you? How do you understand that, and what does it mean personally to you? Greta, would you like to go?
Sure, I can start, because that's the project that we've been engaged in here at West Hill for about 10 years now, as the community has sought to become what we now call a non-exclusive spiritual community. And it has been a process of reflecting on what we interpret the roots of Christianity to be, and that's in a radical message of inclusion that came, we believe, from Jesus in the very early days and was evidenced by the behavior of the very early Christian communities, that radical openness to other, to living beyond the tribal consciousness that had held people apart and separated them, and a recognition that our context now calls us to that same kind of radical breaking of barriers that have been between us, particularly those that are defined by religion. And so evolving church for us has meant being part of the process of defining what those barriers have been, defining what walls have confined us, and then working intentionally to bring those walls down. In our worship, that has meant changing many of the things that would have been standard elements of a service, which now may follow the same kind of format as a traditional service, but the language is radically different, the way that we do things is radically different, the symbols are very, very different. And so we are making, we hope, a community that takes some of the best of Christianity, shakes it free of the dogma and doctrine that has entrapped it for the last couple of millennia, and apply the values that are then distilled out of it into, I'm mixing so many metaphors there, but apply those values in our community and reinforce the values being then lived out in the lives of people who are here out in the world and work toward transforming the world. So it's taking the roots of Christianity, which I believe were deeply embedded in a values-based living, and making them real in community.
Fabulous. Great. Thank you. Bruce?
Thanks, Michael. And it's great to be a part of this wonderful panel. At Canadian Memorial, we have as our explicit mission practicing and teaching evolutionary Christian spirituality. So we're in the midst of this very adventuresome exploration of what are the practices and the processes and the programs that are aligned with an evolutionary worldview and an evolutionary theology. So we think about church as a habitat for creative emergence, for discerning and building upon the new thing that spirit is doing in our midst. And it's all quite new to us, so there's a real excitement about it, but we want to create a habitat, for example, where mythic expressions of the Christian faith or traditional modernist, postmodernist, and beyond, sort of post-postmodernist expressions, explored in community. So like Greta, we're building upon foundation of Christian tradition and really entering into deep discernment with each other around this whole question of what Prophet Isaiah calls, you know, discerning what is the new thing that Spirit is doing in our midst.
Great. Fabulous. Thank you. Ian, would you like to share?
Sure. Thanks, Michael. And also, good to be with the group. My experience has been very similar to Greta's and Bruce's, so I don't want to repeat many of the things they said, although I agree with all of them, and I've had the same experience as both of them. The point that I wanted to make was that I began my ministry in a very conservative place, in a diocese. I was ordained in a diocese where they didn't ordain women, they still don't ordain women priests. So the thing that struck me about that was while society was moving on and discovering more and more equality, church was several steps, in that case many steps behind. And the quote that's coming to my mind right now is the quote from the Catholic Bernard Lonergan, who said the church usually arrives on the scene a little late and a little breathless. So the thought that's coming to me right now is that life itself is evolving, and the problem that we have often in the church is the church doesn't evolve along with society. So what it means for me to be an evolving church is that our community, we call it an inclusive spiritual community, our community seeks to evolve along with life. In other words, to read the signs of the times, to be relevant, to be practical, and to do things, to be things, and to achieve things together which are actually relevant for the way life itself is evolving. So to repeat something that Greta said, what we do when we gather, it should be real. It should be authentic. What we do together, the programs that we run, should actually make a difference in the world today. Not the world that we want it to be, not the world that it used to be, but the world as it is now. So that's the key point to me, is that evolving church is about, I could use the same language as Bruce and talk about, you know, the spirit has its own movement, it has its own flow, and the role of the church is to actually tap into that, understand it, discern it, and move with it. And interestingly, just a theological point here is that having come through an evangelical worldview myself, the German theologian Jürgen Moltmann was very influential for me and was actually part of the bridge for me moving from an evangelical perspective to a progressive perspective. And the key thing was his book called The Church and the Power of the Spirit. And his point in that book is basically that the Spirit's moving, whether we understand that or not, whether we see that or not, it is happening. And so the role of the church is to actually understand that and to get in the groove, to ride within the grooves of the Spirit's tracks, you might say. So that would be the key point that I would make. And to repeat all the things that Greta and Bruce said, our worship, our programs, our life, our style, all of that needs to be relevant and match the signs of the times.
Great. Fabulous. Thanks, Ian. Brian, what does evolving church mean for you?
First, it's a pleasure to be here, and like Ian, I just affirm everything that's already been said. Mike, let me just say one small correction on the bio by which you introduced me. I was the chair of Sojourners Called Renewal for a couple of years, but I've been out of that position now for, 2 years. On this question, two things come to my mind, again, affirming all that's been said. First, that I would say evolutionary Christianity is a fact of history about which a lot of us Christians are in deep denial. I mean, the fact is the church has constantly been evolving. So many Roman Catholics are shocked to learn that priestly celibacy, wasn't required for quite a while. It was just several centuries ago that it became a universal requirement. I think a lot of Protestants assume that, you know, when the Apostle Paul was establishing house churches, you know, they had Sunday schools and organs and hymnals. But, you know, so many of these things, even doctrines that are, you know, very precious to a lot of people, particular doctrines of atonement, for example, these have evolved greatly over history. So the first thing I think that evolutionary Christianity helps us do is to get out of some naivete and some denial about the degree to which the church has always been evolving. And when we can face that, I think it frees us then to embrace our call to evolution and change and growth and progress and learning in our own lifetime. And then the second thing I would say that is very meaningful to me is evolutionary Christianity allows us to look at the work of Charles Darwin and all the others who contributed to evolutionary theory, and instead of always raising a versus and an argument and a fear and conflict, enables us to do theological reflection on the theory of evolution and on evolution as a beautiful arc of history, an arc of creation. And I'll just say, personally, that has freed me in so many ways, and it's raised my vision of who and what God would be, and it's certainly raised my excitement about what it means to be a Christian. So those would be two additional thoughts that streamline right in with what others have said.
Fabulous. Thanks much. Sally? Oh, wait a second. Sorry, Sally. I had you on mute. I'm sorry. I had you on mute, Sally. Go ahead and start again.
Oh, yeah. Well, thank you. Brian, very hard to follow that. Marvels, and hard to follow all of you. I'm not a practitioner in the sense of being a pastor or clergy, but I've always been speaking into church groups, church organizations about culture and leadership and worship. And as I look across the landscape today, when I see the church struggling, I see the fossilization, this desire to remain the same. And, of course, the medical definition of death is the cessation of change. And so I really resonate with what all of you are saying and all of what this whole series has been affirming, that life at its best is transformational. And so at base, I would say church, the evolving church, would be the saying the big yes to transformation, continually transforming, and also to be brave enough to look back at our past and see when we have followed rabbit trails that really are destructive, and to be able to name that, and as part of the evolutionary process, to be able to say, no, went down that path, don't want to go there again. And in that light, I see one issue, a central issue of a Christianity that has developed in that which most people recognize as being the only one, and that is Western Christianity. I would like to see us as the evolving church embrace other forms of Christianity, other approaches that are probably much, they're Eastern, they're a little bit more right-brained, that don't have a lot of the baggage that we have carried with us.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks, Sally. One of the pieces of feedback that we got from two of the other panel discussions, people said that they were really, really great, but they were hoping, there were several people that voiced the desire for more sort of people sharing their actual experience, a little less heady, a little less ideas-oriented, and a little bit more in terms of personal experience. So this next question really comes out of that. It was submitted by Steve Maynard, and Steve's question is actually a sort of a cluster of questions that pertains so directly to the backgrounds of most of the panelists today that and this theme, that I wanted to make sure that we had plenty of time for each of you that would like to go into it. So let me just read from Steve's submission here. He begins a little bit of background. He says, Greta Vosper describes how she was led to change how she did church at West Hills United when she realized that people just weren't getting the message, and in her church as well as 19 other churches that she had surveyed. Since her conversation on this program, I've looked at her church's website and seen the wonderful vision works and other documents that they've helped develop. So clearly, he says, a new consciousness is arising in her community. The question that arises is about what other evidence is arising in the experiences of people at West Hill United and other churches. For example, the churches of Bruce Sangwin, Brian McLaren, Ian Lawton. Specifically, how is evolutionary Christianity making a difference at the individual and collective levels in actual churches? What's manifesting in the heart, souls, and work, both vocational and avocational, of the parishioners? How is the quality of their lives changing, and in what ways? What are the practical impacts of this body of work, this evolutionary body of work, this science-based body of work, for the participants? In other words, how are they living it on a day-by-day basis? So the invitation is to share from your own experience and the experience of your parishioners or others that you've worked with in a church setting, how has this made a difference, and what has been evidence of that? So I've actually got each of you on mute now, so please press *2 to raise your hand if you'd like to respond to that. Bruce, why don't you go? Let me unmute you here. Okay, great.
Thanks, Michael. Yes, so as I mentioned, we are really exploring what it means to teach and practice evolutionary Christian spirituality, and therefore some of the traditional practices, prayer, contemplation, we're carrying forward, but asking what it means then to tap into this sacred evolutionary impulse. And I'd say in a few different ways, it's attracting, what we're doing is attracting a whole lot of younger people who are just ready to move on from mythic or traditional forms of Christianity, but don't necessarily find the postmodernist expression of Christianity, and I could say more about that, particularly relevant. So right at the moment, for example, we have four youngish people who have entered into a formal process of discernment because of a sense of call to ministry. So in some kind of way, this is lighting them up, which is interesting to watch. The other thing I would say is that we're attracting those folks who have a kind of scientific background and who like to know that sort of the empirical method and the scientific method can actually be in conversation with religion. And so they're finding a place where their approach to life is validated. And I would say that the other thing that's practically happening is that we run what are called connection circles, and almost half of our congregation are actually involved in weekly circles that gather together to discuss primarily sermons that I've written from within an evolutionary Christian mystical perspective, and apply that to what it means for their life. How do you actually feel this evolutionary impulse within this yearning to grow in Christ, to evolve in Christ, and to find support for that journey? So things are, it's a bit like an evolutionary Pentecost. That is one way to talk about it, that's happening at Canadian Memorial. The other thing I would say, as I mentioned in my opening remarks, it's all quite new to regard this evolutionary impulse as a fundamental constituent of reality, capital R, and to imagine that God or Spirit or the Christ is implicit in that, so that it becomes an actual norm to expect that not only the tradition of Christianity, but our own precious traditions at the local congregational level are going to evolve and move forward. So I would just say that it's making some real practical differences in the life of our congregation and in the life of members of our congregation.
Fabulous. Thanks, Chris. Brian?
Let me mention one area of change for myself, and then one that I think was true for the people in the congregation where I served for 24 years. For myself, I remember hearing a phrase that all of my evangelical friends probably have heard, and some of us may have even said it, but we've probably heard it 100 times, and it went something like this. The methods can change, but the message never does. Or the content, the packaging can change, but the content never does. Now, first of all, historically, that's just not true. But it was a kind of consensual illusion that we all bought into. When I spent many years thinking that all of the problems in ministry and the problems in the church were problems of methods and problems of packaging, that our message was just fine. But when I came to realize, you know, there really are some problems in our message, places where our message, I think, is actually grossly out of sync with Jesus and his message and with Paul and his message, not to mention a lot of other biblical characters. That had a somewhat terrifying effect on me because it required me to, in some ways, break ranks with an awful lot of the community that I loved and whose respect I cared about and in some ways depended on. But integrity pushed me to say, no, we've got to reconsider our message. And I'll just say for myself, if I hadn't done that, I don't know where I'd be today because my faith has been so reinvigorated and my whole sense of mission and calling and identity, they've just been transformed by a fresh understanding of what the essential Christian message is, especially as it relates to Jesus and his message of the kingdom of God. It's just been revolutionary in my life. And then a way that this, I think, played out in my congregation is that the call to be a Christian, the call to be in some way a follower of God in the way of Jesus, that call becomes a call to the future, not a call to the past. In other words, my Christian identity is more about joining God in the healing and restoration and development and evolution of the world, moving toward a brighter and deeper and richer future. Whereas I think the identity of joining the Christian faith, apart from an evolutionary understanding, is joining the ranks who are holding the line for something that's 2,000 years old and has been fighting against change for 2,000 years, and we will help it fight change for another, whatever more time we have left. A radically different understanding of Christian identity. It affects then what every part of Christian practice means, from baptism to the Eucharist to bearing witness to our faith and so on. So the impact, I think, is far-reaching and profound.
Great. Thank you, Brian. Greta.
Well, I really appreciate what's been said already, and I want to pick up on a couple of things. One, Bruce said, this is new. He's so right. Anything that you do in a community of faith that's beyond the norm is new. And what we are doing, all of us, is really new. And we often refer to the work that we're doing as being on the bleeding edge, because it's not until we've tried something that we actually get to find out what the costs are going to be. We can speculate, but because it's never been done before, we don't really know. And so that the impact of change can sometimes be traumatic. And I really appreciated what Brian said about the method and the message, and we speak about it here as the packaging and the product. And churches are so caught up in the idea of changing the packaging, you know, getting a new plasma screen or a projection system or a band or something that's going to make it look hip, and we haven't addressed that question about the message yet. So that's what we have been doing as the first step, which came out of creating some of those documents when we decided we didn't want to write a statement of faith. We wanted to write something that helped us figure out how to live. It's the, you know, why the way we live is more important than what we believe. And coming out of that have been some interesting things, because we don't focus our study groups on Bible studies on theology, our book study, which has been going. Bruce Sanguine was the minister here before me. I don't know if many of you know that, but he was here before me, and there was a book study going before he was even here, and it continues now, and it's very healthy. But a few years ago, it went through this very interesting shift, and that was when it stopped being. I mean, I have nothing to do with the book study. The books are chosen by the people who participate in it, and they vote at the end of the year and choose which book they're going to choose. And they chose a book by Pete Singer, The Ethics of the Food We Eat, or something like that. But it was a radical shift that I think reflected some of the shifts that had taken place in the congregation, because we were no longer studying books that had to do with what we believed, and we were starting to look at books about how we lived, and those are the books that they have chosen since then, is to look at how we live. And I think that that's really the most profound difference in people's lives. When we started this early on, a member of the congregation who had been here for about 30 years was very well respected and loved. One of those people that everyone would say to you, you know, you're really going to be making her upset by these changes you're making, came up to me after one of our conversations on faith evening, where we were exploring what some of these changes were and what the roots of them, where the roots of them were in the Christian faith and where we were going with them. And she came up to me and she said, you know, I was really kind of nervous about this progressive Christianity, which is how we refer to it most of the time. I was nervous about it, but now I just really want to say thank you. She said, I don't feel guilty anymore. I have always been at this community because I needed community, and I've never believed the things that I thought you needed to believe here. And that was a profound affirmation of what we're doing. And that kind of, because we're creating that kind of community where people, A, can be honest with one another about why they're here and explore and seek to, as someone that from the congregation, a new person who's been here for a couple of months, explored with me today, you know, how do I be better about my relationships in my life? How do I do things better? How do I make better choices? How can I be a better person in the world? Those are the kinds of things that we tackle. And those are the kinds of things that we talk about. We're vulnerable with each other in prayer. We risk letting people know who we are so that we can reflect the truth of someone back to them. And sometimes that makes us stand totally convicted by what the community says to us, and sometimes we're totally celebrated, but we're never not changed by our relationship in the community. And I think that that's one of the strong things about this community.
Yeah, that's great. You know, what you just shared, Greta, reminds me of, I think the biggest difference in evolutionary Christianity for myself and also for the countless people I've worked with in this field, and a pre-evolutionary or a mythic understanding of Christianity, flat earth Christianity maybe, I don't know, just a pre-evolutionary understanding, relates to the difference between focusing on having the right beliefs, like that's the card key, that's the ticket to an otherworldly paradise after I die, and that's really what it's all about. And if you have the right beliefs, you're in.
Mm-hmm.
To where you really begin to recognize that, no, the emphasis is on being in right relationship to reality. And whether you use traditional language or more contemporary language to speak about that, that's really what it's about. And that's what spirituality is about. It's the practices, the exercises that lead us to be in harmony and right relationship to reality at all levels. The reality of our closest, you know, family and friends and our neighborhood and our cities and our bioregion and our community and so on and so forth. And all of that cannot be divorced from language about right, you know, being right with God. And so I just celebrate what all of you who are working with churches are doing and have been doing. Ian, I notice your hand's up. Let me unmute you there. Okay, go for it.
Great question, by the way. I really appreciate the question, bringing it back to a practical level. You know, the answer for me personally is, in one word, freedom. It's just an incredibly relieving feeling of liberation that I have when I think back to where things began for me to where I am now. And I'll tell you a bit about the C3 community, which is the most amazing group of people that I've ever come across in the world. make me look good because they're so incredibly progressive and evolved in so many ways. But where it began for me, I actually had a flashback while Brian was speaking of a time when I was in seminary. And this is a, you know, as I said before, a very conservative seminary. A guy came to me and said to me, "You don't sound like a Christian." And I thought to myself, what does a Christian sound like? Should I be talking in falsetto or, you know, in hushed tones, or should I be sounding more pious, or, you know, what is it? And I had people trying to convert me even when I was in seminary, because I've always been a bit of a square peg. But it was such a strange experience. I've given up a lucrative career in the local gas station so I can come and study in seminary, give my life to this thing. And my fellow students are trying to evangelize and convert me. So because I sound different, or I don't use the same language, or whatever the issue was. And then in my first parish in the inner city of Sydney, we were on the parade route for the Sydney Mardi Gras. And so we had, you know, literally hundreds of thousands of people all walking and hanging around our church. The people in the church wanted to close the doors, and I wanted to open the doors. I wanted to have coffee and tea. I wanted to be inviting people in. I wanted to be mixing with the group who were there for the Mardi Gras, and the people from the church wanted to close ranks. And that was my first clue that this was not going to be a good match for me. I don't need to move on. So my early experience was one where what happened in the church was completely divorced from what happened in the world. My evolutionary experience, and the reason I find it so liberating, is because now what happens in the church community matches what happens in the world, in the local community. That's the most exciting thing to me. So give you a couple of examples out of the C3 community. When I first arrived, a group of people were very passionate about issues around ecology. What they did, a small group of them started a local Earth Day event. It wasn't a church event, it was a community event. The first year they had something like 6 people turn up. Second year, maybe 20 or 30 people. 5 or 6 years later, there are now hundreds of people that gather for this local community Earth Day. They don't even know that it actually sprung out of the C3 community because a small group decided to start it. It doesn't matter that it came out of C3. The point is that it happens. It's a, you know, it's a life-affirming event that brings a lot of people together around a common value. That's one example. Another example is a group that's forming right now around alternative energy issues. We've got a wellness center that actually has moved in and used part of our space on our campus. And they're, you know, they're 5 or 6 different practitioners doing various things, from more conventional therapy to massage, nutrition work, Reiki, yoga, all sorts of work. We've got a Zen center that is housed on our campus on a Sunday morning at 9 o'clock. Our main gathering's at 10 o'clock. At 9 o'clock, in one room you've got a group of people meditating. In another room, I'm leading a group of Bible for progressives. In another room, we've got a group of people with the New York Times out having a current affairs conversation. There's everything that's going on matches what's happening for people in their Monday life. There's a really strong Sunday-Monday connection that takes place at C3, and I just can't emphasize enough that it's liberating for me, and they tell me that I've liberated them just to be themselves and to express their faith in a way that actually is consistent with the way they live their lives, and not to do it separate, not to have a kind of holy life, a sacred life, and then a real life that takes place on a Monday. Bring them both together. So, again, great question, and like the others who've spoken, this is starting to happen at C3 and in many other places. And for me, the big thing is the bringing together, the merging of life between Sunday and Monday.
Yeah, wow, that's great. Fabulous. Thank you, Ian. You know, I've got about a half a dozen questions, some submitted ahead of time, and 2 I'm noticing that were just submitted in the last 10 or 15 minutes, that all revolve around sort of the same theme. So let me see if I can try to piece these together in a coherent question. It relates to the uniqueness. Okay, this is sort of my paraphrase in some of it. there's a lot of different organizations and groups of people and institutions that are helping people to be in right relationship to reality in different ways. There's people doing peace and justice work and sustainability work and ecological work and recovery programs and therapy and all kinds of things. And a lot of it has to do with helping us become better people, to become greater integrity, and to live, you know, with greater, you know, generosity and everything else. What's the uniquely Christian element? Like, why? Let me read a couple things here. One person says, you know, at what point do we go so far beyond mythic traditional expressions of the Christian faith that we're really dealing with a post-Christian spirituality? Someone else says, Leslie Robinson wrote in, says, as Christianity evolves, what will be the unifying element for the new community? Is a specifically Christian focus actually essential, or will there be a broader community? And then somebody else, Charlie Reese, asked this question, again, related. How might the panel members draw a meaningful distinction between an essential evolutionary Unitarianism, for example, and evolutionary Christianity? In other words, what it makes this distinctively Christian other than a specific history of individuals? So any of you who would like to address any of this sort of cluster of things, please press star 2. I see Sally, you've got your hand up. Let me unmute you.
I'm going to speak into the practical area regarding worship, so if there's a chance to do that later, I can certainly do that. No, I'll defer to the question at hand. Anybody who wants to grab that, fine.
Okay, great. Greta? Wait a second, I'm having trouble with my mute button. I'm just going to unmute all of you and... but still press star 2 when you're going to when you want to speak, but I'm just going to unmute all of you because it's taking too long for me to unmute. Okay, so each of you is unmuted, but go ahead, Greta.
Okay, you can hear me?
Yep.
Okay, great. That's a question that I frequently get when I'm speaking. What makes this a uniquely Christian movement or a uniquely Christian experience, and what elements of the community draw it together around distinctively Christian roots? And my response is often... That I'm not looking for something that's distinctly Christian. And that, I think, was one of the messages that Jesus was trying to make, was we don't need these distinctive barriers that keep us apart from one another. And we feel safe when our boundaries are defined and we know who we are and we have things that identify us clearly so we can recognize each other. But I know that several of the conversations that several of you have read, the Empathic Civilization by Jeremy Rifkin, and he pulls us beyond those definitions that we keep trying to put in place so that we know who we are, and says, we have to look at each other and see that we're human and develop ways, ties to pull each other together. That said, the things in religious community that heal people, that make them feel whole, that give them the strength and the courage to go back out and do that peace and justice work, to work at that shelter, to deal with those women that have been beaten up for the 16th time and they're back in the shelter again. You know, what is it that religious community does to give them that strength? And it's the community itself and the relationships there and the trust that's developed. But that community is defined and people identify strongly with it because of its ritual and its symbols. So we do need to find ritual and symbol that will help define community. Will we be able to find a story, symbols, language that will, I mean, my argument is that we should use street language. We shouldn't be using distinctive language. But will we be able to find a narrative that extends beyond all of us that we can all tune into the same way that we have with this traditional Christian narrative? I don't know. That's why it's called the bleeding edge. What will happen if that narrative is so differentiated between communities? I think that's an okay thing if we start raising up the values as what we're being called to. And in that, at that table, at the table that has the values laid out on it, I can pull up to that table with people from all walks of Christian interpretation, as well as those of all the great faith traditions, as well as those who would eschew any kind of faith tradition and have ideologies of their own, if those values are what we place on the table and what we talk about.
Oh, great, thanks. You know, what you just shared and the fact that Sally has such a background in helping congregations to think through what worship even means. I see a couple of you have your hands raised, so I'm going to let me go ahead and call on Sally now, because I also want to, after you share, Sally, there's something else I want to come back to around worship, because Connie and I have started these evolutionary revival services, which are draw on the traditions of revival services, and they're deeply evolutionary and deeply transformative, and yet they're not exclusively Christian, but they're certainly inclusive of all Christians, but it's not exclusively Christian. But anyway, Sally, go ahead and share.
Oh, I was just really getting excited, Greta, about what you were saying about these empathic communities and erasing the boundaries as much as we can. And I think that we can do that and still draw deeply on the well of our traditions, the best of who we've been. And I see, for instance, in the great Christian expanse of 2,000 years, the best of who we have been following Jesus Christ out into the world with compassion, first and foremost, and self-sacrifice. That I see is some of the best of what it means to be followers of Jesus. Included in that would be our this heightened sense of justice that not only has a legal or a fairness aspect to it, but this self-giving. The Christian default to a self-giving God. I think that those things we would do well to remember and then draw forward, not using them as boundaries between ourselves and others, but to remember what has been done well, what has been modeled well, and to bring that forward. And in terms of worship, practically speaking, what I see happening is this desire that Ian spoke of to connect God with all of life. I see that so much in young people who are wanting to plan and craft worship differently. And I just had a discussion yesterday with a young woman up in the Seattle area, and she has been charged with the task of creating a brand new worship service in a satellite church. This would be the second church of a large mainline denomination. And she was struggling with the idea of programming it, with giving this community a theme and then a series of services. And I said, you know, in my experience, the best worship starts in community. It starts in relationship. So instead of starting a service, open a space for people to be with each other and to learn about each other's lives and to share their gifts with each other. And out of that, then, let there be a celebration of some sort. And they will figure that out if you guide them through that and open up this space. That's what I'm seeing more and more of. Instead of just saying, we need this kind of a service, how about give people the room to know and serve each other and celebrate that?
Yeah, that's great, Sally. The way you shared that had me think something I hadn't quite thought of before around worship, is that for many churches, both liberal and conservative, and it's not just the conservative, you know, Pentecostal, charismatic expressions of the faith, but even more liberal expressions, worship has come to sort of mean honoring a supreme being up there, out there somewhere, rather than a celebration of life and all of its fullness and a recommitment to serving life and to being a blessing to life and to asking, what is life speaking to us? How is life leading us? How is reality leading us? So thanks for triggering that. I see Brian, you get your hand up.
I'm kind of going back to the previous question about it's funny, this question comes up again and again in so many different ways, but I'll sort of shrink it down to the question of Christian identity. One way to say it is the brand of Christianity so tarnished and so polluted because of historic atrocities and the bad behavior of so many kind of well-known Christians today? Is that brand so tarnished? And the very idea of a strong religious identity, is that an inherently destructive thing that we have to move beyond? And I've been in so many interesting discussions about this with different people, and you know, each side on this argument, if there are two sides, have great points to make. But I always think about a lot of my conversations with my Muslim friends, and I'll just share an anecdote that's come up maybe three or four different times. A Muslim conversation partner will say to me something like this: "We actually prefer being in conversation with fundamentalist Christians over liberal Christians." And I'll say, you know, that I find that a little bit surprising because, you know, a lot of the fundamentalists, the first message they want to get to their Muslim friend is that they're going to hell. And I always think that would be a bit chilling on a conversation. But they say, no, when we're talking to our fundamentalist friends, they have firm commitments and deeply held beliefs, and they express them. And that leaves us free to express our deep commitments and firmly held beliefs. But when we're with more, quote, liberal Christians, they tend to suppress their beliefs because they don't want to be rude to us. But when they do that, they leave us feeling that we have to suppress our beliefs as well. And I just think that response is very, very interesting. And it opens up the problem of when we try to create a kind of commitment and belief-free zone, that can become another kind of hegemonic or colonizing space that feels like it robs people of their particularity and identity. So my little shorthand on this, I think the thing that we're seeking for, that we're trying to evolve into, if I can use that word, is this. We know how to have a strong Christian identity that is hostile toward people of other faiths. And we know how to suppress our Christian identity in a way that is benevolent toward people of other faiths. Is it possible to find a strongly Christian identity that is strongly benevolent and hospitable and friendly toward people of other faiths? That's just a way for me to try to define the struggle and the challenge.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks, Brian. Bruce, let me unmute you here. Hang on a second. Okay. Go, Bruce.
Thanks, Michael. Yes, Brian, thank you for your comments. I really found myself getting lit up by what you were saying. And I love your phrase, a generous orthodoxy, as well. Because, to go back just a step, and one of the stories you told about interfaith conversations, in my own experience, I have much more in common with a postmodern Jew or Hindu or Muslim than I do with a fundamentalist Christian. And that's because in this evolutionary perspective, we move through emergent worldviews to simplify, you know, from pre-modern to modern to postmodern to post-postmodern or integral. And when a postmodern Hindu or Muslim gets together with postmodern Christian, it's that worldview that comes through more than anything. That's the shared value, to use Greta's phrase. But it's my experience that young people are longing for a lineage. They're not wanting to exit tradition. They're wanting to find a lineage and then ask the question, what's new? What new meanings can we bring to the Orthodox theology? And I find that when you start interpreting Orthodox doctrines such as, you know, the virgin birth or incarnation or the ascension or the cross or resurrection, in and through this evolutionary perspective, by doing what I sometimes call cosmological midrash or evolutionary midrash, everything comes alive. It all awakens. So I'm I think, more sort of aligned with Brian's intuition here that, and I love the way you put it, have a strong faith with a strong sense of respect for the distinctiveness, because this universe is evolving according to a principle of unity in differentiation, or differentiation within unity. And so I the whole project, the whole postmodern project of blurring, in a sense, those distinctions, I don't think is where we need to go, actually. So that's a little bit about what I wanted to say there.
Great. Fabulous. Thank you. Greta, I see your hands up.
Yeah, I wanted to go back, and I can't even remember who was saying it at this point. I think, but anyway, it's about language and and comes out of this whole conversation about you know, where we are in relation with other faith groups and those of no faith, and how we define our boundaries and stuff like that. And language has been used. I was saying earlier that people, we want to define ourselves, and language can be very, very inclusive and identify who we are. We use our language, and it is an inclusive element, but it is also extremely exclusive. And my experience of youth and of young adults is that they don't care about the Christian story. They do care about the world. They do care about the people around them. They do care about the issues. And they do care about finding a way for humanity and life on the planet to evolve and continue to do so without, you know, beyond them. But the retraining and reconfiguring the Christian story is not a significant element in the lives of those that I'm familiar with. And I think that the huge lack of youth in mainline denominations is some evidence of that, and not just evidence based on the fact that we don't reconfigure that language and come up with new interpretations. One of the ways that I try to explore and explain how important I think it is that we find ways to explore our basic commonalities and the values that undergird so many different faith traditions and ideologies is imagining the person who comes to my church, a 27-year-old who's, you know, got three kids and parent has just, you know, something terrible has happened with their parent. They've been trying to live a good life, but they're falling apart. Their marriage is falling apart, whatever. They manage to fall in my front door because they seem to remember that church might have something to offer them, even though they've never gone before. Their parents didn't go before. It was only their grandparents or the ones that they remember were ever at church. Well, how much of my story do they have to get straight before they can participate and be held in community? When we open our gatherings, we take a few moments and everybody intentionally places into the space with them and with the community those things that we cannot risk losing in life. And they're those cornerstones of our faith about compassion and about right relationship and about love and about justice. And we call ourselves to be attentive to them. Anyone can be attentive to them without having to know a new interpretation of the myriad of biblical stories. Not that those stories aren't incredibly rich and can't be explored in a worship time or in an opportunity, a speaking time, a meditation time with a community. I think we can explore those and do it very, very well. But I think that at the end of that exploration, we cannot assume that then the community has our understanding of, Bruce used the ascension. You know, if I preach this really very evolutionary understanding of the ascension, which would be a challenge as far as I'm concerned, but if I were to do that And everyone's hearts were moved, and they had this new understanding that really made sense to them. I cannot assume that next week whoever's in the space has that understanding. So I can't use the word ascension without going back and articulating everything that I had said before. So the stories, they're not just out there with these new interpretations. And as soon as we make a new interpretation, we create a closed community unless we reiterate that new interpretation each and every time we use the word. So, you know, we used to have this big gulf between the pulpit and the pew, and that's been filled in now because people in the pew have access to scholarship. They have access to these new interpretations. Do we want to build a gulf now between the church and society? And I think Ian is recognizing that there needs to be a connection there. We need to be talking about those same things that the world out there is talking about, and not doing it in archaic language and imagery that they really don't connect with.
Yeah. Wow. What you reminded me of was a conversation that I had. I don't remember which who it was in this series, where I'm sort of on a crusade to invite ministers, preachers, pastors, priests to subscribe to Science News, to go to the New York Times, Science Times, and preach on some of the things that God is revealing through science, through evidence, and to use that as a basis of sermons and that sort of thing, precisely because it's a common language that is culturally accepted. Ian.
I'm bursting out of my skin here. Greta, I'm sending you a big high five through the phone line here. Each time you've spoken tonight, you're singing my music there. I appreciate it. By the way, several people have been trying to get Greta and I together for several years. When I say get together, I mean we're both happily married, but have a conversation together, and we haven't quite been able to do that until tonight. So this is really interesting for me. What Greta was saying is really, really dear to my heart, and I want to echo something of it, not repeat what you said, but just echo something of it. It seems to me that we need to use language which is relatable to people every day, and not just beware of the religious language, but also beware of technical language. And whatever it is, this thing we call evolutionary Christianity, not to create a new set of technical language which is going to further distance us from people who, for the most part, bypass the church altogether. And they're finding their spirituality is being nurtured through yoga practice or through other wellness practices or just through life itself. So I'm very interested in having a real world language. Now, this is the interesting thing to me. As we speak, Joel Osteen is on Piers Morgan. And I know because I watched a short video of it this morning that he is going to be saying to Piers Morgan that homosexuality is a sin. And apparently this is clearer than he's been in the past. Now, this guy has, I don't know, 10 million people tune into him every Sunday morning. But the issue that I have there is, I mean, obviously I disagree with him, but the issue I have is that he sounded confused about why he thinks that, other than the fact that the Bible seems to have some teaching in that regard. It's so polarizing. You either agree with that or disagree with that. And my experience, and this is the issue that I think we have in this gray zone of what the identity of Christianity is. Is it based around certain beliefs and tradition or not? You know, Joel Osteen's representing one aspect of that tradition. You either agree with that or not. Obviously, a lot of people resonate with him. We're in this gray zone where we're dealing with the people who are just hanging in Christianity or just hanging in the church. And then there's the mass of people who are outside the church, bypassed it altogether, never been interested or been interested and then left it. What I'm interested in is that in my community, it's the values that people are resonating with. It's the universal values that are bringing people together. And then for those who are Christian, they're tapping back into the tradition and finding examples, language, stories
that manifest those values. And then for other people, it might not be the Christian story, but it's the values that's the key thing. And it's the values that seems to be the exciting thing for us moving forward, where we can actually make a difference in the world. We can actually create the type of world that we've longed for, that we've talked about for years, by manifesting these values. Now, you know, the tradition, it's almost like, for me, the details of the tradition are almost like an accent. And even within one country, you can have, you know, wide diversity of accents. That's about the level of distinctiveness. The values is what's keeping us together. And to me, that's very exciting and a very exciting development within this evolutionary field.
Great. Thank you, Ian. I've got a lot of questions, some of which have been now submitted in the last half hour, and then I've got two sort of clusters of questions here. I want to make sure that we have time for these. Again, they sort of revolve around main issues. Here's one related to stages of development. It's actually Richard Powell was the first one that suggested this. Richard is a very active participant, one of the most active participants in the community blog pages. And he begins by noting, this is a direct quote, not much has been said about personal and social development yet in this series. I personally think that many people leave a church because they outgrow it, and it doesn't offer what they need for their next stage development. I'm thinking of the idea that there are stages of development, including stages of faith. The most compelling models in this field are based on the work of Claire Graves and popularized by Don Beck and Ken Wilber. So here's the question. Should churches provide stories, answers, and opportunities for each stage of development and also for transitioning from one stage to the next? Or should there be a different church for each stage or some subset of stages? The trouble with the church for each stage model is that family members would end up going to different churches. So if you'd like to respond to that, please press star 2. Okay, let's see. Brian?
Well, first, I know that we should hear from Bruce on this because I know Bruce has written some important work on this. And like the person who sent in the question, I'm very impressed with the work of Claire Graves and all the folks involved in Integral and Spiral Dynamics. This question makes me feel great because I have a book coming out in March called Naked Spirituality that is built around a four-stage framework of faith development. So I'm right with this the person sending in the comment and the question. And my hunch is that most churches, as the questioner said, most churches really work well for people in a stage or maybe stage and a half, or maybe you could stretch it to two stages. But we haven't evolved yet into churches that do a good job of creating space for people in multiple stages. I think that's one of our evolutionary challenges right now in the Christian faith. And it's a new challenge, it's a new opportunity, and it's a new need that we face. And I think something maybe we can learn from evolutionary biology in this regard is that evolution creates diversity. It creates multiplicity. There's not one form of butterfly or one form of snail or one form of whale. So that would mean that we should expect our churches to develop different responses to the challenges and stimulations of their environment. And as Greta said, you know, sometimes being out on the bleeding edge is being an early mutation whose differentness hasn't proved its survival value yet, but it always looks odd at the beginning, but that could end up really being something valuable and needed and important. My hunch is that these kinds of churches are in fact beginning to come into being. The problem is that people who've been deeply discipled or catechized or spiritually formed in early stage churches have been taught to see these things as evil. And life will get, in other words, anything that's beyond them is liberal or evil or in some way mutant. what will be interesting is when a new generation of children are raised in these churches so that this idea of diversity and pluriformity and where the Christian faith is more about the way we live than a list of doctrines and so on. It will be interesting to see what happens when generations of children are raised in that context, because we don't have that many examples of it up till now in history. That's where this really is a bleeding edge kind of a thing. So great question, really important.
Great. Thanks, Brian. Let's see, Greta?
Well, I would really want to defer to Bruce, perhaps, because of the work that he's done on this, as Brian has said, but we need to be careful that in the church, and I agree that churches really cater to one stage and rarely to, because it's just too risky and there's so much conflict when you introduce new stages to former ones. I mean, it's like evolution. You mix the groups that have partially evolved in it, and it just creates chaos. So I think that churches try to protect themselves by having just one stage within them. The simple, straightforward stages that Fowler put out there, which are he would argue that most people are in a stage where they have accepted as truth, primarily literal truth, what the authorities in their lives gave them as truths, and that the next stage is when you realize that, you know, maybe there was more to the story than what you were told, which sort of sinks you into this big spiral, often of despair, as you have to reorient your world. And then there's another stage where he argues that we pick up those things of that former stage, and now we understand them as myth, and we can speak of them as myth, and we can reincorporate them into our lives in a different way. And that's a very healthy process. My problem with that is that the last stage, that latter stage that I spoke of, which is not the last stage in Fowler's stages, but that latter stage looks, smells, wags its tail an awful lot like the first stage. So if we who are in leadership in the church, and this is, you know, the work that I found that people weren't just getting it, this is what I recognized, that I was using all the same language in my head. Of course I had it in the last category. Of course I had hit a different stage. Of course I understood it mythically. You know, I understood it as story. I didn't understand it literally. But I still talked like I understood it literally. And so people weren't getting that I didn't understand it literally, because I was still using that same language. And it was when I realized that, that things had to be reorganized in my leadership and in the work that I do.
Fabulous. Thank you, Greta. Bruce, several of your colleagues have pointed to you, and I know I've experienced you in this regard, having a lot to say, so please share some of your experience on this stages understanding.
Thanks, Michael. And thanks, Brian and Greta. Indeed, it's my experience that when we have this conversation, in my book, The Emerging Church, I read a chapter called What Color Is Your Christ? Because Don Beck actually color-coded these waves of consciousness, or these worldviews that we emerge into in response to shifting life conditions, this evolutionary impulse to meet challenges. And that's why I talk about the congregation as an ideal setting to be a creative habitat or a domain of creative emergence. I do like what Ken Wilber talks about as the possibility for church, the Christian church, a conveyor belt for people who are ready and willing. Everyone has a right to be exactly where they are, but by creating a non-coercive habitat for people to evolve along a line of spiritual intelligence seems to me to be a core purpose of the church, because other institutions are doing other stuff that we've done in the past as well or better. They're doing social justice. They're doing community. They're doing values. And but so I think that if we're not helping people to evolve along the spiritual line of intelligence and claim their identity and to what I call living into the heart and the mind of the Christ, then we do lose something distinctive about who we are, and I would question myself if I'm not interested in that conversation about what is distinctive about our own lineage and where are we going, and doing, yes, the hard work of interpretation, but it's my own experience that people are meaning makers, love to interpret, come alive. It's part of what it means to be human, that it's not a disincentive. Rather, it's a source of allurement along this line of spiritual intelligence. And I think that, you know, for me, it's what I'm about. So I personally can't – that's what we're experimenting with. And I appreciate that Ian and Greta are experimenting with a different way of being church. So it's going to be interesting to see what emerges from the mix here. But so there's a little bit about what I'm thinking about.
That's great. Thanks, Bruce. I'm glad you mentioned the whole notion of a conveyor belt because I don't know, I don't think I actually shared this at any point in this series, but my book, Thank God for Evolution, I trained with Don Beck, and I've read a lot of Ken Wilber, and of course very familiar with the integral model and taught spiral dynamics a little bit. And my book was very much of an attempt to be a conveyor belt, to help mythic people move into modern consciousness, to help modern people move into postmodern, and to help postmodern move into integral, and to help everybody wherever they are to sort of like continue to expand their circle of compassion and care and commitment and ground their spirituality, their religious orientation more in evidence. So thanks for mentioning all that. Sally.
Yeah, I'm just sitting here enjoying all of this. A couple things. It just occurs to me while we're speaking of how we do church, it has so much of what we used to call well, some still do, a Christendom flavor to it, i.e. church is a place, and also how it's developed is that we do church for people. And so I'm sitting here and marinating what you're saying, but I'm going back to what Bruce just talked about in terms of these habitats where people can express who they are, where they are, and what I'm gathering from him, a little bit more organic way. And instead of us doing, espousing a worldview for them and doing church for them, understanding that if we are doing it, if we as a leader have that view that we are creating church or programming church for people, then we will not be including many of those colors. We will not be including a rainbow. If we, however, are using a more organic approach and letting people come at life from exactly where they are, and number two, if we are letting them express and articulate that in more than just words, in multivalent ways, through art and story and film, we will really have much more, a much richer tapestry of this this thing that we call life and reality and all the different views and means, however you want to approach that. But if we take what is really quite a modern construct, our institutionality, and number one, kind of dump our default out from the leadership point of view, and number two, rely on only language, only words, and linear thought, I think we are not going to be getting this rich approach that we are talking about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Great. Thanks, Ellie. So we've got about 10 minutes, and there's two questions that are related, and I'm sure this will take up the rest of our time. In fact, we may go a few minutes over, so I just want to remind folks that our next panel discussion is Saturday at 1 o'clock, or I'm sorry, 2 o'clock Eastern, 11 o'clock Pacific, and it will feature two Nobel Prize-winning scientists, Charles Townes and Bill Phillips, as well as Franciscan Richard Rohr, Brown biologist Ken Miller, and Harvard astrophysicist Owen Gingrich. And the topic will be The Heavens and Earth Declare God's Glory. So that's on Saturday. But I want to sort of have a crescendo, and this is going to be a really juicy question, I think. So I'd love it if each of you sort of would finish up on this theme. I'll just read, it has to do with any movement of faith will necessarily need to provide for deep emotional needs of individuals. So David Elliott writes, people will still need to be saved. People always need to be saved. No change happens without the human heart being deeply forgiven or moved or comforted. What does that look like from an evolutionary Christianity perspective? And somewhat related to that, Jim Zyko says, this is a direct quote, he says, in my opinion, the issue of a personal God is so important that the success of the effort to reconcile science and religion may in fact depend on it. As a species with self-consciousness, we wrestle with the problem of human suffering and inevitable death. A religion that doesn't provide faith or trust for all that is, A religion that doesn't provide faith or trust that all is for the best and will turn out well in the end can't expect to survive. And he says, I expect that an evolutionary Christianity that best addresses this issue is the one that will gain the most adherence in the long run. And he wonders what the panelists think about this. So again, this has to do with sort of how we communicate in a way that comforts and gives the core emotional feeling space that humans have always needed to thrive, like comfort and gratitude and trust and inspiration, that sort of thing, and how that is communicated from an evolutionary context, and this whole notion of a personal God, and how do we relate to that. I mean, I've said many times that for me, it's important to remember that Jesus did not believe in a personal God. Jesus related to reality personally, and there's a radical difference between those two. But I want to just allow all of you to speak on either of these themes as we bring our call to a close. And I've got the lines open, so any of you can speak.
Well, this is Brian. There's so much there to work with, and let me say one brief comment about four of the topics that were brought up there. First, on the word forgiven and the importance of forgiveness. I think for many people, their primary portal into faith is a sense of guilt and shame, and what they desperately need is a sense of forgiveness. But I was a pastor for 24 years, and I just have to say that wasn't the case for a lot of people. For a lot of people, their portal into faith was an experience of mystery and wonder and glory and awe. And I can think of other people, their entree into faith came through a need for empowerment, which is something quite different than forgiveness. And I'm sure we could think of many other things that bring people into faith. So that's not to deny the importance of forgiveness, just to say that I think there are many portals into faith. And to stereotype or to require everyone to pass through the same portal, I think there's a long tradition of that in Christian faith, but I think that's problematic. The word personal, a personal God, I think here again we have to ask what do we mean by personal? For a lot of people I meet who call themselves atheists, what they say is, I don't believe in a God who is a white male with a long beard sitting on a golden chair. So when people hear the word personal God, you know, they often bring in all of those kinds of associations. If by personal we mean something greater than ourselves as opposed to equal to ourselves, that's very different. And I just think that might add a little bit of clarity on that subject. And then on the issue of giving us hope regarding death and suffering, I certainly think that's the case. And my belief is that the approach to Christian faith that many of us are exploring and discovering gives more hope to more people than what we inherit, than the version we inherited. So none of us, I think, want to foreclose on hope. But we also don't want hope to be the proprietary, to be a product that only a limited few have the franchise to purvey.
Fabulous. Thank you, Brian. Ian, would you like to address this and anything you'd like to say in closing?
Yeah, again, a great question. And, you know, I appreciate the question of bringing it back to the human experience. I tend to agree. I think there's some universal longing for certain things that are expressed in different ways and different languages used for them. And the way I've been thinking about it in the last week has been around the issue of surrender. And I think just as someone who believes in a personal God looks to surrender to the will of that God, so someone in recovery looks to surrender to the support of their higher power and the support of their group and their sponsor, just as a musician surrenders to the creative process, just as an artist surrenders to, you know, the movement of their work, just as I believe every human being at some point surrenders to something or some sense of something which taps them into that which is greater than all and yet present in each, by any name, by any description, and by any experience. The reason I still run a church, even though I'm a square peg, is because I'm interested in that universal human longing that I experience myself, and I resonate when people talk to me about what they're longing for, and I believe there's a universal message that meets that human longing. And I think the Christian story is as good as any at offering entry points into that human longing. I've heard it from everyone tonight. Sally, the last thing you said was absolutely brilliant about going beyond words. And one of my answers to the question about how to do integral in community is I think in the past we've expected that the community is defined by the Sunday morning sermon, which is a set of words given for 20 minutes. And I think going forward, we have to be more than that. I think our communities have to be made up of people who, some of whom find that their spirituality is evolving through the words of the preacher. Other people find that their spirituality is evolving through the action groups that they belong to, or the art groups that they're part of, or the meditation groups that they're part of. People are going to come into communities in such new ways going forward. And I think that's one of the ways that we can tap into different stages of development, because we can meet people in lots of different ways. So yeah, that'd be my last thought. And you know, I'm really grateful to be part of the group tonight. I feel that I'm in good company, and I feel that we're in an experimental gray zone now, where the fact that even amongst this group of people we have some diversity is a good thing, because we're trying some different things. We're meeting different people's needs along the way. And we'll look back at some point and say that worked and that didn't work, but it's all right, because you've got to try something. So thank you for including me in this, and thank you to all of you as panelists for a great conversation.
All right. Thank you, Ian. Sally?
Yes. Thank you, Ian. I'm just stunned by all of this. I was just thinking again in terms of this personal aspect. One of the things that we really can't deny is the trajectory towards this bonfire of the personal. Facebook, it just that alone it would be enough for us to understand. If we want to connect God, church, to real life, this is where it is. This is where people are, 6 hours a day. I mean, some people are spending on Facebook. It says something. It means something. That maybe it's not, you know, we've come to say, this is cliche, it's belonging before belief, but, you know, I'm really beginning to wonder if belonging is not belief. That they are now
becoming equivalent, so that we are understanding the universe not so much as ideas or things or stuff or material, but as relationship. And so whatever the community, this growing community of evolutionary Christianity decides about this question of the personal, what we cannot ignore is that everyone on this planet has that as a priority.
Yeah, that's great. Fabulous. Thank you, Sonia. And thank you especially for bringing in the whole relational element. One of the things that we heard a lot of from some of the Catholic theologians in this series is this relational theology, that everything is about relationship. Greta.
This is such a great question, and all of these questions have been great, and it's been awesome to participate with this panel and hear the diverse perspectives that are still so affirming. It's wonderful to be part of this, so I really want to express my appreciation for that, as well as a marvel at your ability to be attentive to everything that everyone says and has said through this whole series, and stay tuned into everything. You're quite amazing that way, Michael. But This is, I think, a key element about us going forward, is how do we, beyond the previous story, how do we still recognize and honor the human quest for affirmation, for transformation, for groundedness in community. And I think that while we may have argued that our perspective was the way to do that in the past, each of us recognizes that that's not the truth. I'm in the middle of a series on the Academy Award nominees, and we looked at Inception this past week, and we're coming up to look at 127 hours this week, and we'll be doing The Social Network. Each one of those, The King's Speech, have in them stories of redemption, of overcoming personal barriers, of looking into oneself and dealing with one's own demons. And so I think that there's a lot out there culturally that draws us to the same themes that our stories have offered us in the past. And we can draw those connections, or we don't have to, but we take those stories and walk toward the hearts of the people that we're in relationship with the power of those stories with us. And so using art and music and so many different things to touch people based on what it is that they respond to, we have that opportunity to be in those transformative moments in people's lives. And I think that's an incredible gift. I used to call myself a non-theist, because I thought it sort of talked about not believing in God as a separate and distinct being, supernatural being with interventionist powers and abilities, that it talked about God as something else. But I'm finding that term is not clear enough either about what I believe in. And so now I'm beginning to call myself a non-realist, in that I don't think there is something separate and distinct. But when I talk about God, I'm talking about what I create in the world that is good, that brings beauty, that strengthens someone's resolve to be goodness, to live with beauty, and to explore what truth means to their own personal self. And as much as I can do that, I create God in the world. So God is a manifestation of the best that I can offer the world. In community, as we encourage one another to create that, kind of God, I think that's an incredibly hope-filled community. Derek Jensen wrote an article a couple of years ago, to probably 4 or 5 years ago, about hope, and talked about how we have used that word so often to cripple ourselves or to silence the cries of misery that we hear. We offer hope and then we don't do anything about it. So hope always has to come with a hammer or something, as far as I'm concerned. But the hope that you put, so that's the kind of hope that we have in community, is hope that is really lived into the world, because we are responsible for creating God, what I call God in the world, and that then pulls us into an accountability to one another, an opportunity to shoulder one another and to shelter one another when we need to. And so I find that a very hope-filled image, a very personal image, a very intimate image, a very vulnerable image, but the image that I take forward. So I really appreciate this question and the opportunity to be able to respond to it.
Great. Thank you, Greta. Bruce.
Thanks, Michael, and thanks to all of you wonderful panelists. It's been wonderful to be in conversation with you. And this question also is close to my heart because, in fact, in my own sort of evolving journey, the whole project of struggling to open my heart in love has been an ongoing one. And, in fact, I realized that I needed to go back and do some work on that in the context of therapy, because this condition of feeling safe, I think, is basic to evolution, to feeling safe, love, to feel a sense of belonging, without which no one's going anywhere, and the universe certainly isn't going anywhere. And so I have my own experience is that there is a first principle at work in the universe, which is that we live and move and have our being and our becoming, but we are more or less open to that. And when I talk about congregations as habitats or domains of creative emergence, part of what that means for me is we have to be places where people can experience a deep sense of belonging and experience being deeply loved. So really important, and that leads into the question of, you know, whether God is a person or personal. And the way I tend to address this is to say that it's taken the universe 13.7 billion years to arrive at the qualities that we associate with personhood, love, empathy, compassion. And so, indeed, if we are evolving in and towards the heart of the holy, then we can certainly assume that the heart of the holy is love. And so, no, God, I don't think of God as apersonal, but rather profoundly personal, way more than we can ever imagine by that term, but certainly not less. And so we talk about, I like what Integral has done with the three faces of God and Terry Patton and Ken Wilber, that God emerges in human consciousness over history in three primary ways. One is sort of the depth of our own being. So God is the great I am. Jesus says, before Abraham was, I am. Or God, and this is the kind of personal kind of the identification of God with the deepest part of ourself. And then there's God as the beloved other, who we experience as our lover, as a presence who invites us into and towards a relationship. And then we can also fall in love with God, the face of God as an I-it, fall in love with God as the face of nature. And I think that what we need to be conscious of in congregational life and the life of the community is that we validate all three faces of God, the mystical face of God, which is God in the first person, the God as beloved other, and then the God of nature, who evokes a spirituality of awe and wonder. So I'll end my comments there, and with the other guest panelists, Michael, thank you for your incredible work on this series.
Well, thank you, Bruce, and thank all of you. In fact, I can say confidently I speak for all our listeners when I thank our guests, Greta Vosper, Brian McLaren, Bruce Sanguin, Ian Lawton, and Sally Morgenthaler. And I also like to thank all of you who submitted questions, whether we actually use them or not. Connie will post the remainder questions on the panel's blog page, which will be up in about an hour. And so please feel free to carry on the conversation there. And as I did with two of the other teleseminar series, or the, you know, these panel discussions, I'd like to invite all of us to just take one or two big, deep breaths and just bring our heart into that place of gratitude. I invite all of us to just remember that if it weren't for the countless sacrifices, the suffering that countless beings, human and non-human, went through to live long enough to reproduce, to add their creative energy, that if that hadn't happened, our life, we would not exist. So I invite us all to just feel that gratitude for our ancestors and all those who have contributed whatever they've contributed today to make this moment, to make our lives, our thinking, this technology, and everything that we have and everything that we are possible. And may we now look to the future with a sense of joyful responsibility that we get to play a role in contributing our energy and our gifts toward the reality that future generations will experience. And let's just be with each other in that silence for 10 or 15 seconds. Amen. Amen. Well, I'm now going to ask our audio engineer to please unmute the phone lines so that all of our phone participants can generate a collective goodbye.
Goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye.